Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Welcome to Joyce Barry and Friends, the number one worldwide radio show. The show's outrageous and it's contagious. It will lift your spirits high, you'll feel that you can fly. Transform your attitude, fill it with gratitude. Cut loose and improvise, it's coaching time today. Joyce is a great coach with an extraordinary approach. Fast on the upbeat, top of the heap. A wild motivator, great stimulator. Unstoppable in a humoristic way. Life lessons with passion, joyfully today. You want Joyce as your coach if you want this to be your best year ever.
Coach Joyce here. I want this to be your best year ever. I want this to be my best year ever.
Welcome to Joyce Barry and Friends. We are broadcasting live across America and around the world. This is the Hour to Empower with stimulating talk, views you can use, memorable quotes, and powerful life lessons. We always have hot guests and cool topics. We even have cool guests and hot topics. You always want to tune us on, tune in, and tune up with us to hear the best of the best. You do not want to miss any of our shows. Each show goes into our archives. Log into Joyce Barry and Friends.com, Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E, and you will see each guest and each topic on our homepage. You can play and download any of our shows, always informative, inspiring, and motivational. You want to share these special shows with your friends, family, and contacts. You can follow us on Facebook and become a Joyce Barry subscriber and even a fan by going to our Joyce Barry and Friends fan page. Be sure to check like. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us by going to our Blog Talk Radio homepage and clicking follow right below my picture. You can also message me in any of these venues about our show, about our guests, about anything. My official website is joycebarry.com. Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E. The chat room is open. Log into the chat room, have fun, and chat away. I go back and forth into the chat room during the show to see what is going on in there. Motivation, inspiration, and an education. Positive, happy thoughts to improve your life, health, and finances. Take positive actions to create a gratifying lifestyle. Life lessons from me, your host, Joyce Barry, straight from the Coach's Corner. And then you will hear from our wonderful guest today. Folks, every day should be treated like a special day. We wish you the finest of friends, the opulence of opportunities, the magic of miracles, and the happiest of days. May this year be your best year ever.
Folks, I'm so excited about today's show because it's all about Israel with one of my favorite guests of all time, our friend Joel Freeman. So what a show. Folks, you don't have to be Jewish to appreciate this show today. You'll learn a great deal about Israel, and who knows, you may even want to book your tickets to get out to Israel. Just very briefly stated, officially the state of Israel in the Middle East on the southeastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. It borders Lebanon in the north, Syria in the northeast, Jordan and the West Bank in the east, Egypt and the Gaza Strip on on the southwest and the Gulf of Aqaba in the Red Sea to the south, and it contains geographically diverse features within its relatively small area. In its basic laws, Israel defines itself as a Jewish and democratic state. It is the world's only Jewish minority state. The prime minister serves as head of government. So I promise you a fascinating show. I just wanted to tell you that little bit about Israel, and hopefully it will entice you to stay tuned and hear all the rest of it from our friend Joel Freeman, a highly accomplished author, an internationally sought-after conference speaker and workshop facilitator, professional counselor, success coach to executives, behavioral analyst, organizational culture change specialist, corporate trainer, motivational consultant, and mentor to pro athletes, multiculturally astute with travels to 50-plus countries. He's a photographer. He's an award-winning filmmaker. He is passionate about dynamic, fun-filled excellence. He's a devoted husband and father. He has a life motivated by curiosity. The only thing I could say about a Joel that isn't recognized and highly acclaimed is that he, by his standards, he's an extremely bad dancer and off-key singer. And that should be the worst you have to say about anyone. PhD, author of 6 internationally acclaimed books and 28 foreign editions, endorsed by such notables as Steve Forbes, Ken Blanchard, Les Brown, Brian Tracy, Bill Cosby, so many others. He's listed in Marquis Who's Who in the World. He served for 19 years as a mentor chaplain for the NBA Washington Wizards from 79 through 98, and as president of the Freeman Institute consulting firm. He facilitates staff development, leadership, change management, cultural competency programs for leaders of other nations, government agencies, music and entertainment industries, faith-based organizations, and corporations throughout the world. And I promise that these music and entertainment industries that he works with, I'm not going to let them know that he's an off-key singer. So you have my word on that. Joel is one of the world's foremost authorities on Black history, and he is not Black. He knows as much as any scholar about Israel. He loves Israel, and he is not Jewish. I love Joel Freeman. Joel, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Joyce.
And I'm so excited about your recent trip to Israel. My goodness, you just got back, so this is hot off the press. What would you like to say about Israel? You can start anywhere, end anywhere, whatever you have to say. I can't wait to hear of your experiences.
Well, I think that the first thing, I know, and I've taken a number of groups over to Israel over the years, and one of the primary issues that people talk about is how safe is it? And all I can say is every time I go to Israel, it's probably the safest flight I take going to or from Israel because of the way that they vet everyone who's on the plane. And then when you get to Israel, it's just people live life in a situation where there's maybe 70,000, 80,000 Israelis surrounded by 430 to 450,000 million, I'm sorry, 70 to 80 million versus 430 to 450 million Arabs all around, and they're in a kind of an open spot there where it's open season on them, it seems like, and yet it's one of the safest places on the planet from my perspective. I know that we were there about 2-3 years ago, and I remember waking up in the morning in Jerusalem, and our guide at the time, Raz Sabar, he said, "Do you know what happened last night?" It was a Saturday morning, and we said, "No," and we were all asleep. And he says, "Well, 140 rockets were shot from the by Hamas last night, and not one of them hit a soft target. They all were either shot out of the air with the Iron Dome technology, or they landed in a spot that was uninhabited and allowed to land in that spot. So it, I thought to myself, and then I came home after that trip, and I tried looking on the media here, did anyone report on these 140 rockets being shot at a sovereign state? And I finally found something that may be two or three lines long on the internet, but nothing in the major mainstream media. And I thought to myself, here in America, if Mexico started shooting rockets across the border into Texas or Phoenix, Arizona, or Canada started shooting rockets, I mean, they might get one rocket off, and that would be about it. And I just think of how people view what is going on over there. So safety, I just think it's an important thing to know that people in Israel probably would have a harder time coming to Washington, D.C. or Baltimore because of all they see on the media about the murders and the crime in these two cities. And yet, they would much rather live in Israel, just to give kind of a context.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking I listen to CNN a lot during the day. There's just so much going on with the missing Malaysian plane and so much else. There wasn't one word about any of that. As you were saying, and I was thinking, and I have the news on a lot, especially since the incident with the plane and what's going on. So why do you think that is, Joel? Why would you say that it doesn't even make the news, something like that?
It doesn't. And I think it's I just don't know quite how to wrap my head around it. I think it's the way the media is viewing Israel. You know, there's quite a movement. They call it BDS, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction. And it's such a misguided movement, because it's literally one-sided, and it has to have a rather judgmental view of Israelis, to view Israelis as invaders, and to not even take the context of history and those types of things in account. And then to take a look at the history of the Palestinians, who really came mostly from Jordan, and were never called Palestinians prior to this time, and it really causes one to wonder, why don't all the other Arab states allow this sliver of land to be occupied or be lived in by Jews, and kind of help out, if they are considered refugees, help out the Palestinians. Now, I know, and I hasten to add, there have been crazy things on both sides. You know, Israelis, I think our guide this last trip, Iftach Berman, you know, said you have to be a little paranoid when you consider living as a Jew in that region of the world. And some of the bold statements that are made about wanting to wipe every Jew off the planet and to wipe every Jew out of Israel. Those are statements that are made by people in power positions in Arab nations. And so you have to be a little paranoid and a little bit, wondering how long are we going to be able to take this? So it's a day-by-day type of situation. And this last trip, we were up in the northern region. When I take trips, we generally do things off the beaten path. I try to keep it down to one bus load. I keep it limited so that we can be more nimble and move about. And I always have two or three surprises for people, things that aren't on the itinerary. And on this last trip, we went up, Iftach went to school with the commander of the base up on the Lebanon border, literally 100 meters from the border. And they're, the soldiers there on about a 25, 30-second response time, and they could be in the dead of sleep, and in 30 seconds they've got to be ready to go. to defend the land. And so just to get a sense of the commitment, the passion, the high level of training that goes on, and to realize that these guys are there, I mean, it's first degree protection. It's not layered. I mean, you've got many other layers, of course, but they are right on the front line. And to realize that this isn't games, they're not in some other nation doing any nation building or anything like that. They're there literally protecting the sovereignty of the country and the protecting the lives of men, women, and children throughout the country.
It's just mind-boggling to me that people really don't get it about Israel, and to this day there are so many there's so much anti-Semitism going on. And from the very beginning, May 14, 1948, David Ben-Gurion, the head of the Jewish Agency, declared the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel to be known as the State of Israel. The following day, I can't even comprehend how this could happen. The following day, the armies of four Arab countries, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, and Iraq, entered what had been British Mandate Palestine, launching the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Saudi Arabia sent a military contingent to operate under Egyptian command. Yemen declared war but did not take military action. In a cablegram of the same day from the Secretary General of the League of Arab States to the UN, Secretary General, the Arab states gave a justification for this intervention. After a year of fighting, a ceasefire was declared and temporary borders known as the Green Line were established. Jordan annexed what became known as the West Bank, and East Jerusalem and Egypt took control of the Gaza Strip. So here, the day Israel, the Israelis there were celebrating, they had their state. The very next day, the fighting started, and you know what? To this day, there are many countries who want to wipe Israel off the map. They don't want a Jewish state. They want to kill the Jews based on all lies and evil propaganda. How upsetting is that?
Well, you know, it's everyday life for people living in Israel, and it's one of those things that I think we all adjust to the realities. If someone lives in an urban setting, they adjust to the street noises, and they learn how to sleep with the window open, with cars passing by. Someone in a rural setting might go nuts and crazy in an urban setting, and vice versa. You know, someone in an urban setting would go crazy with all the silence and quietness and open skies. And so I think we all adjust to the various different places that we live and the environments that we live in. And people in Israel have adjusted, and they literally take it day by day. It's, you know, God gives the grace for another day, and hopefully tomorrow there'll be safety and be able to live our lives the best way we can to provide for our families. And so, you know, I'm not Jewish, as you mentioned, but I love the Jewish people. I love the land. Just even the topography of the land is fascinating to me. For instance, in the Bible, when it has the Psalms of Ascent, as people in the olden times, in the Bible times, were coming to Jerusalem for a festival season, they lift their eyes up into the hills from whence cometh their help. It says, my help comes from the Lord. And that's looking at Jerusalem from a topographical standpoint, looking up, moving up toward it. And then from a spiritual standpoint, moving up toward Jerusalem. And as we when we take trips to Israel, it's usually about a 10-day trip. And we arrive generally in the afternoon, and my goodness, it's just quite remarkable. For the first 3 days or so, we're up in around Galilee region, and we visit Mount Arbel generally, and overlook the Galilee region, overlook Capernaum and Chorazin, and Bethsaida, which are the triangle that Jesus spent much of his time in that particular triangle. And then we go generally over to Nazareth and Cana and Megiddo, and then we head on over to Mount Hermon and Banyas, or Caesarea Philippi, from the biblical name for that particular place. That's the place where Jesus asked his disciples, "But who do you say that I am?" And then we head over to that's at the base of Mount Hermon, and then generally we get over to looking over into Syria and into Jordan, and just to see these different sites in that region. And then we move on down to generally with a stop off at Bethshean. And some other places along the way, maybe have a baptism in the Jordan, just at the mouth, near the mouth of the Dead Sea. And then we head on down to spend the day in going through Masada and taking the cable car up to the top of this epic place. Just astonishing place. And then to soak in the history there. And once at the top, you can look over, and there's En Gedi, the place where David hid from Saul. So when we come back down off the cable car and head on over to En Gedi, about another 20-minute drive or so, 15, 20-minute drive, and then we go single file all the way up to the first, and then the second waterfall, and the third, and just spend some time there, just taking it all in. And then we head over to Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And my son and I, back about 20 years ago, my oldest son and I, we hiked all through the Qumran caves. And I'm not sure if we were supposed to or not, but that was what we did for almost a whole afternoon and maybe three quarters of the day. And spend a lot of time just overlooking the Dead Sea and talking about the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls and their impact on our understanding of the reliability of Scripture. And then the next day we head on over.
But excuse me, Joel, before you continue, can you say a little bit about the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls? I'd love to hear more about that now, if it's okay.
Oh, absolutely. The Dead Sea Scrolls are probably one of the more significant, or perhaps even the most significant find in the last three centuries, and simply because it's something where when you start to think about the Dead Sea Scrolls, you begin to realize that, you know, here they were found in right around 1948 by a young Bedouin boy who was looking for his goat. That's at least, I don't know how apocryphal that story is, but it at least tells a little bit about how the scrolls were found. And then we begin to realize now, after taking a look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, that there was kind of almost a radical Jewish sect, perhaps known as the Essenes, that occupied that area. And we know that they, it's probably the greatest manuscript discovery of all time. They found in from a number of caves, they found from 11 caves, they found between 1952 and 1956 fragments of all Old Testament books. The entire book of Isaiah was found in Cave 4. And then Cave 4 and Cave 1, by the way, were the most productive caves. The copper scrolls were found, and in there, there's 64 sites around Jerusalem where treasures are supposed to be found. And there's actually some treasure hunters using clues from the copper scroll trying to find these treasures. And Cave 11, there's information about the future temple being built in Jerusalem at the end of the age. And the reason why they found them in the caves is because we find that the Romans came in, and perhaps right around 70 AD when Titus surrounded Jerusalem, there was a lot of panic throughout the region, and they figured that you know, we're in trouble, but we need to save all of these scrolls. So they put them in large jars, pottery jars. And by the way, the Essenes, they were very manic about cleanliness. And they had a mikvah, or a bath area there. They took ritual baths to purify themselves. They would make, they had a whole section of the Essenes making pottery. And so after they ate their dinner, they would, instead of cleaning the pottery for another day, they would smash it because it was now unclean. And they would have to have fresh pottery made for the next day. And so they made these pottery jars that were perhaps maybe 2.5 feet tall. And they put these vellum, these leather, these scrolls, if you will, not all leather, but scrolls in these jars. And because of living next to the Dead Sea, you have the salt as a purifying and preservation, preservative factor to it. These scrolls were able to survive all this time. And they hid them there because they didn't want the Romans getting these scrolls. So that's why they were preserved all this time. And what is really cool about this is that we know that the that the Old Testament canon was completed right around 450 B.C. Because on the road to Emmaus, after Jesus was resurrected, and we're at the Easter time now, and just we think about that, he then joined with two men on the road to Emmaus, and after they were all done, they said, "Didn't our hearts burn within us because the way that he unfolded the scriptures or expounded the scriptures to us?" Now, what scriptures were they talking about? They were talking about the Old Testament canon, Genesis to Malachi. The Old Testament canon had been completed. And we know it was completed around 450 B.C. because Josephus wrote a book called Contra Appian. And in there, he wasn't trying to prove anything. He just basically said that the canon of Old Testament scriptures had been completed around the time, around 450 B.C. And then we also see that the Masoretic text, which was started around the 6th century A.D., was completed around 900 A.D., at the Talmudic academies in Babylon and also in Palestine. But then we realize that that was done, that was completed around 900 A.D. And then the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Hebrew text, was completed, done around 250 B.C. It was a translation process that occurred during the reign of Ptolemy Philadelphus, and perhaps the most complete Hebrew text that existed prior to this. And so what happens here is, here we have the Masoretic text, 900 A.D., Dead Sea Scrolls are dated right around 990 B.C., 100 B.C., right around there. So we have a leap of a millennia, 1,000 years, which is huge when it comes to archaeology. And now to be able to compare the Old Testament passages, and remember, all the Old Testament books are in the Dead Sea Scrolls with the exception of Esther. Why Esther? Because God's name was not mentioned once in the entire manuscript, the entire book of Esther. So it was suspect in the Jewish mind. But every other, Isaiah, Exodus, Genesis, every other book in the Old Testament is there in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so what's cool about this is now we have this glimpse into all the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. There's some well over 100 prophecies about who the Messiah was, and when he'd be born, where he'd be born, how he'd be born. That he'd spend some time in the Galilee region. Zechariah talks about this Messiah would be sold for 30 pieces of silver. Zechariah 9 talks about he'd be enter into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Psalm 22, that not a bone would be broken on his body. He'd be pierced through his hands and his feet. he'd be born of a virgin, Isaiah 7. Micah 5 talks about Messiah being born in Bethlehem. So now we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt, no swoon theories, no Passover plots, nothing. That now we know that all the Old Testament prophecies were in the book, in the bank, so to speak, before the time of Jesus. And so it's really interesting. That, to me, is the resounding impact of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes, and, Joe, that is fascinating. But in the scrolls, at that point in time, when and where did they say at that point in time that the Messiah would be born, when and where? How exactly was it stated? This is all stuff I did not know about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, wow. Well, it talked about, in fact, they were very interested in the Messiah. It's now believed almost 100% that John the Baptist hung around and was probably even part of the Essene community, known as Qumran, and that perhaps even when you start looking at where Jesus was baptized, literally miles from the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, miles from the community. And when he went into the wilderness to pray, to hang out, probably went to that region. Maybe they even knew who he was. And so who Jesus was. And so it's very fascinating. And so when you start looking at the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah, Micah chapter 5 and verse 2 says the Messiah would be born out of all of the continents. It would be in Asia. Out of all the countries in Asia Minor, would be Israel. Out of all the provinces, it would be Judea. And out of all the towns, it would be Bethlehem. And born of a virgin, and Isaiah 7, verse 14, and the Hebrew word for virgin is Alma, a very specific word. Isaiah 9, 1 through 7, it says that the spiritual work of this Messiah would be done in Galilee, by the way of the sea, along Jordan. In Zechariah chapter 11, verses 12 and 13, he'd be sold for 30 pieces of silver. Zechariah 9, 9, and Isaiah 53 is an amazing chapter, and when you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can see, I think in just Isaiah 53 alone, you can see how close it is. There's 17 different changes in what we have today based on what is in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and none of those 17 changes have to do with, or differences, I should say, have to do with content. It has to do with punctuation or, you know, just style, if you will. And so it's really kind of cool to be able to compare what we have today, take a millennia, a leap of 1,000 years, and to find out it is almost exactly the same thing in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's what, when I look at the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah and then juxtapose that against, you know, the story of Jesus and others, I'm just astonished by the symmetry and the similar nature. And you know, if I were to say, for instance, there's a guy by the name of Robert Anderson, you know, there might be hundreds, maybe thousands of Robert Andersons around the world. But every new feature, if I start saying, well, he's from Chicago, and his address is on Maple Avenue, and his social security number ends with 1234. He's an engineer. Start every new feature about this R. Robert Anderson narrows it down to only being one person can fulfill the identity of the Robert Anderson I'm talking about when we start looking at all the features about this particular person. And I think the same holds true with the Messiah. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think, are one of many pathways that lead us in that in our research and understanding.
That is really amazing information. Sounds like we need a whole show on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And a whole show on Joel Freeman, for sure. You are, like, amazing, Joel, the wealth of information that you have and on so many different things. I would love you to talk a little bit about the significance of the Holy Land, where the name came from, and the Promised Land. How that all ties in.
Well, I think that when we start looking at the Holy Land, you know, first of all, when I first thought about the whole Israel, you know, I mean, when you look at the original promise to Abraham, it actually includes points all the way over to the Fertile Crescent. Israel is literally only one-tenth of what Jehovah promised Abraham. And remember, before Abraham, there were no Jews. Abraham was just a regular guy that God said, I'm going to make your name great. He made some promises to him. And out of the eight covenants in the Old Testament, four of which were conditional, four of which were unconditional, this is an unconditional covenant. There's no ifs involved. If you do this, I'll do that, as with some of the four conditional covenants. But this particular covenant, he said, I'm going to give you the land, and you can begin to take a look at this whole region, this huge area that encompasses much of Iraq and so many other parts of that, the whole region of that part of the world. And then when you follow the whole, ranging from Abraham to Isaac and Joe, you know, this promise didn't even begin to come to fruition, even an inkling, until Joseph came on the scene four generations later, which really gives us quite a glimpse into the long view of Jehovah, long view of God. When he makes a promise, he keeps it, and even if it takes four generations for it to even begin to start to be fulfilled, it's on his timetable, it's his chronology, and that's why Abraham is known as a man of faith. And when God made the promise, he said, look up in the stars in the sky. How many stars are there? And Abraham said, they're numberless. I can't tell you how many there are. Look at then a little bit later he says, look at the sand or the dirt on the ground. How many granules are there? How many grains of sand are there? Abraham said they're numberless. They're just overwhelmingly it's infinite. Well, I think that there are children of Abraham, both by DNA, by the dirt, by the dust, if you will, and the stars, and by promise. And so, there are two categories of people, the Jewish people and people who believe in the God of Abraham, and I believe in Yeshua myself. That's my belief, can call Abraham their father by the Spirit, by faith, by promise. If you follow that all through and you begin to realize that there is this this line, this lineage that now we bring it up to being in bondage, and by the way, that was part of the prophecy. He said there's going to be some 400 years that your people will be in bondage in Egypt. And when the Exodus occurred, and the whole story, how Moses was in a bulrush, and he somehow, all the young Hebrew boys, two and under, are being killed, murdered by Pharaoh, but Moses is spared. He ends up becoming the deliverer. And then they come, they wander around for 40 years, and then they come to the Jordan River, and both the Red Sea and the Jordan River are miraculously opened up for them. And then they begin to conquer this land that had been promised, but a whole generation of unbelievers, a whole generation of people that were caught up in the negativity of the wilderness had to die off in order for this new generation to be open to this promised land. Now, the thing about Israel that I find fascinating, when you look at the Silk Road in Asia and some of the other ancient trade routes, one of the prime trade routes of the entire ancient world of that time in that region was the Via Maris. It started up in the Fertile Crescent, came down through Damascus, and came around to past Megiddo and all the way down to Egypt. And it was this rich trade route going back and forth between Egypt and the Fertile Crescent. And what happened is it passed through Israel. And so we have this people that God said, I'm going to create you and develop you as a client nation, if you will, to be a light to the Gentiles. That's what it says in the Old Testament, to be a light to other people, and which they blew many, many ways. And it's just astonishing. We hold our heads and say, you saw so many miracles, and you the waters were parted, and you saw a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And yet you know, the next day you disbelieve, wanting to go back to Egypt and all the different things. And I think it's such a picture and such a kindergarten lesson about human nature. I struggle with that. Every one of us struggle in some way with sometimes disbelieving and just trying to wonder what is really going on, try to figure things out on our own. And yet God never gave them a bill of divorcement. Never walked away. But here's what's cool about it. Instead of them going out to the world to be a light to the people, other people, instead, it's like God chose a small little sliver of land that whoever controlled Megiddo would control the Via Maris, would control that trade route. And that's why when you go to Megiddo, the Valley of Jezreel, you begin to realize there were over 200 battles fought there. Why? Because everyone wanted to control Megiddo. And so it's just an amazing thing to think about that God would place this nation, this small little nation of people that grew probably there maybe 1.5 to 2 million after 400 years in Egypt. And now they're coming into this land, a whole generation had died off. Now they're there. They had to fight giants that were in the land, according to the spies that came back and told Joshua was going on. They had to fight the Jebusites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Ammonites and all the ites. And still, they could only occupy part of this tiny little land. And so it's pretty astonishing to me to see, to kind of back up, okay, that's what happened. And then to take a look at the spiritual implications from that we can take a look in our own lives, that there are certain things that were promised, that are given to us. But we still have to fight the battles. You know, it's like having a radio talk show or a radio show. You know, it's a gift that you've been given, Joyce, but every day you have to fight the battle. You have to bring in something fresh. You have to do something new. It is giants to conquer the land. But it's something that is yours. It's your territory, and it has your name on it. But I think it's quite a picture of life, and I think that's why in the New Testament says that all the things that happened to the Jews were all an example for us, so that we can learn from it and somehow gain wisdom from it all. And the story continues.
That was a great metaphor, Joel, and so true, so true. No matter what your territory is and what you're up to, there's always battles to be fought. There's always the next level, the next thing to do to better what you've done. Folks, first of all, let me wish all our Jewish friends around the world a very happy Passover. We're smack in the middle of Passover week, and that's why it's such a blessing and an honor to have Joel Freeman with us this week. It makes it especially significant for all of us. I just want to refer you to Monday's show, where we had the very esteemed Rabbi Potashnik, Rabbi Joseph Potashnik, who ushered in Passover. We had our Passover celebration, and that show was chosen by Blog Talk Radio as one of the best of the day. It was put right on top of their homepage endorsing the show, Rabbi Joseph Potashnik celebrating Passover. Yesterday's show, I did this show solo to cover the Passover story in detail and its traditions. So that would be yesterday, April 15. You'll find these in our archives. And I must say that the moment this show goes off the air, you'll find this show in our archives as well. Folks, I just want to share with you that besides these incredible and holy holidays, Passover, tomorrow's show with Beverly Nadler, we're going to do celebration of the Jewish people. We're going to have a talk about the comedians, the jokes, all the funny things, the light things that are so much fun that the Jews bring to the world as well, contributions, trivia, that kind of show tomorrow. And then on Friday, we have the very honorable Pastor Timothy Henderson with a celebration of Good Friday and Easter Sunday, which is that weekend. So we're doing our Easter show this Friday. Just want you to know that you should be listening to the show every day, not just Passover, not just Easter, but every day. Here's why, in the words of Beverly Nadler.
Listen to me. I have something to say about a wonderful way to start your day, a way to stimulate your mind and increase your energy, make you feel so good. And guess what? It's free. Weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, hear the Joyce, Barry, and Friends show. You'll find it on the Internet, on Blog Talk Radio. This show is upbeat and fun and very inspirational. It's informative, educational, and very motivational. There's the Coach's Corner, great quotes and news. There are suggestions, perspectives, and advice you can use to enhance your life and improve your health, plus clever, simple ways to increase your wealth. Joyce's perceptions and personality will keep you captivated, and her guests from many walks of life will always keep you fascinated. When Joyce and her friends speak, it's like you're in the conversation. This is part of what makes her show so unique, really a sensation. For Joyce's friends are not only the guests you're listening to, they're everyone who is tuning in. Yes, I do mean you. So refer your friends and family. They'll be so pleased to know. And let's make Joyce, Barry, and Friends the number one Internet radio show.
Indeed, indeed. And you can help that have that happen, folks, by going to Joyce Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E, and friends.com. On the homepage, left side, right under my picture, click follow, and you'll be apprised of all the shows every day, the guests, the topics, and what we are up to. Just click follow right under my picture on the homepage. We apologize for the technical glitch. We are back. Joel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so I was on with tech support, and they just had it handled. We apologize for that. So thank you all for hanging in there and listening to us. I'll have that edited out, so we'll have another perfect show with Joel Freeman. Joel, before we continue, why don't you tell people your website, how they can reach you, how they can get in touch with you?
Well, I think if they go to IsraelCrazy.com, that'll give a very quick overview about the Israel trip I lead every year. Israel Crazy, just as it sounds, .com, IsraelCrazy.com. And that's probably the best one for this particular show.
Okay, but you do so much else out there in the world. Do you want to refer them to your official website as well?
Well, yes, they can go to greatworkshops.com, greatworkshops, plural.com.
And you'll find out more about Joel Freeman, Israel Crazy. We'll talk about the tour, and you just might want to be on the one next year. I'd like to talk a little bit about Israel, the Israel that I know. You have the sophisticated Israel. When I went there, the two things that impressed me the most, one was the Dome of the Rock. I did not go there, but from where I was standing at the Wailing Wall, I could see the Dome of the Rock. So, Joel, I'd just like you to talk a little bit about the Dome of the Rock, and I'll talk with you as well on the Wailing Wall.
Okay. Yeah, it's a I've been in the Dome of the Rock and also the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that was a number of years ago. And it is according to Islamic tradition, the place that Muhammad went up into the heavens. And it's probably, if you were to compare it with the size of the original temple, Solomon's temple, Solomon's temple would have been about 4 or 5 times larger, just to give you an idea of the size of Solomon's temple. It was Solomon's temple on that exact site? We don't know. Some scholars believe, and archaeologists believe, that it's over a little bit, that the Mosque of Omar could stay where it is, and Solomon's temple would be several hundred yards away from it. If you're looking at the front of the Mosque of Omar, or let's say from the side of the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, it would be to the left of the Mosque of Omar. And the tradition is that Mount Moriah, that is Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount, the place where Abraham was offering up Isaac for a sacrifice. It is also the traditional place that when David had committed a sin at the time of numbering his troops, and and God really was angry with David, King David, and so he went to this place, and it was a threshing floor owned by somebody else, and the man said, and David said, "I want your threshing floor." And the man said, "You can have it. You're the king. It's yours. You take it." And David said, No. Anything I do here is done by sacrifice. I've got to pay for it." And so he paid the man handsomely for that spot. And so it is, it's a place that's rich with history. In ancient times, it's believed that that's the belly button of the world, so to speak, that when the earth was, the world was created, that this was the place where it all started. So who knows, but that's Jewish tradition.
And the Wailing Wall, did you visit that while you were there?
Absolutely. And we always, there's what is known as the Kotel Tunnel, where there is excavations being done underground. So you follow the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, down underground, to where it turns a corner under the Arab sector of the city, and no excavation can be done under that, of course, because of the political ramifications. But it is pretty astonishing. There is one huge, enormous stone that people still scratch their heads. So I think it's the largest stone of ancient times that was moved into place as a, I think it's 52 feet long, about 4 feet wide, and about perhaps 15 feet tall. Just huge. It's just hard to even imagine how anything like that could have been moved. But that's what you see, one of the first things you see and one of the first stops when you look at the tunnel and the wall, following the Western Wall all the way down. And then, of course, most of Jerusalem is built up. It's kind of like if you and I were standing here and I put 7 or 8 baseball caps on your head. Each baseball cap would represent another civilization. And so if you look at Jerusalem today, it is probably in most places 9 to 15 feet above where it was at the time of Jesus. And so when you go down along the Western Wall, there's a one point where you see first century stones, and you know that was first century. That was the time around Jesus when people were there at the temple and along the wall region there. So it's pretty exciting. It's going to the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, is quite an experience. It's hard to put into words. And especially the evening, Friday evening, when Shabbat starts, there's a lot of joy and dancing and singing around the courtyard there and near the wall. And it's quite an electric feeling, just watching and observing. And I really am very, very touched every time I go visit the wall.
And that was the truth for me as well. It just reached me in every part of my being, my heart, my soul, standing at the wall. I just felt I was at the most religious place in the world that I could possibly be, on holy ground in Israel at the Wailing Wall. And that's a place where people put notes in the wall, little notes in the wall.
Yes.
There are thousands of notes in the wall, and I was sure to put a note on the left side of the wall, one on the right side of the wall, and one in the middle. And I stood even and I kissed the ground that was there. I was just so moved. Like Joel said, it's hard to put in words. It was a very emotional experience for me.
Yeah.
I spent perhaps a week, 10 days in Israel myself, but I would say that was the highlight. And the Dome of the Rock, that was interesting to look at there, because that's worshipped by the different faiths. That's significant to the different faiths that are there. Anything else you want to say about the Dome of the Rock? Because it has significance for Islam and for the Jews as well.
Yes, and that's the point of contention, is
right.
Because as we read Old Testament prophecies, and as I was mentioning about the Qumran caves, the Qumran community, the Essenes, they had a whole scroll just about the building of a new temple. And who knows how that all is going to happen. I mean, there are, once you get away from the Temple Mount area, there is a group go into the Israel, the Jewish quarter, and there's a place where they actually, there's a group that's building items for the new temple. And it's interesting to talk with them, and they are just as sincere as can be. And some believe it's going to happen miraculously. Others believe that it will be built stone by stone, as it was with Solomon's temple. And they are actually making the implements, the menorah, the candlestick, and then also the Holy of Holies, the mercy seat, and all of these different items. It's very fascinating to consider what they're thinking. So it's quite something when you look at all the different faiths there in Jerusalem, and you can see the juxtaposition and trying to live with each other in harmony and unity as much as possible, given that you know, there is such a controversial aspect of living in Jerusalem itself, when you think about the different faiths that are there and all wanting to lay hold to different aspects of the city.
Absolutely. And the Passover service ends with next year in Jerusalem. And on Monday's show, they asked the rabbi, why aren't we saying this year in Jerusalem? It's always next year in Jerusalem. And that's because we're always planning and that there's more to do, the rabbi said, in fun, of course. But that's how the Passover service ends. Folks, once again, all over the world, I want to wish our Jewish friends a very happy Passover. We're going to give you a great show for Easter Sunday, and on Friday, it's Good Friday, we'll do that show with the very honorable Pastor Timothy Henderson. He does a great job when he's on our show. Monday show, once again, you can hear from Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, the Honorable Potasnik on the Board of Rabbis. Yesterday's show, all about the story and traditions of Passover. Tomorrow's show with Beverly Nadler, the fun part of being Jewish, the jokes, the trivia, all that kind of thing. And a lot of people that are Jewish, their names are different, so you don't even know they're Jewish. We'll let you know who they are, the movie stars. And I would say the Jewish people have more notable comedians that impacted our culture on a fun level than any other denomination. We have so many of them, Don Rickles, Jerry Lewis, and I could just go on and on with that. So, and one other show I want to refer you to, that would be Joel's extraordinary show on Israel in our archives. You simply arrow down to December 19, 2012, and you'll hear an extraordinary show with Joel Freeman and Pam Thompson about what is really going on without the hype, without all the propaganda that comes from the other side, the haters of Israel. Joel, what would you like to say to sum up?
Well, I just think it's important on everyone's bucket list to think about how they can visit Israel. And I don't care in terms of faith or anything. Just look at it more even through the lens of history and geography and topography, and just to view it as kind of a time to learn about some ancient historical realities that occurred. It's just an incredible country. And when you think, you know, Mark Twain wrote a book called Innocents Abroad in 1869. And in there, he said he visited Palestine and the whole region and said it was just terrible, desolate, nothing. A few Bedouin tents here and there. And that it was just nothing happening. And then to consider where we are, you know, what, 100 plus years later, and it's the Old Testament, and Isaiah said that, prophesied that it would blossom, bloom like a rose. And, you know, and you start looking in, around and look at the agrarian economy and at the oranges. The Jaffa oranges are world famous. You look at the technology parks, just full, brimming with brilliant people creating things that impact our cell phones and everything. You know, if people want to boycott Israeli goods, they better boycott their cell phones and so many other pieces of technology. And so it's pretty interesting to think about what is going on in the land and the people that have such a sense of passion, not only about the history, but also being Israelis in Israel right now and being a part of continuing the legacy. And I would encourage, if you want to go to IsraelCrazy.com, that's Israel Crazy, just as it sounds, as crazy as it sounds, IsraelCrazy.com, and feel free to find out if this is the trip that you might want to take next year.
And having taken a trip to Israel, I can't endorse it highly enough to be with someone like Joel Freeman. My goodness, it doesn't get better than that. IsraelCrazy.com. And go to GreatWorkshops.com as well. Find out more about Joel and his life beyond Israel. He has so many extraordinary books. He is a great scholar on Black history. We do shows with him on that as well. My goodness, when I look at all the websites he has to find out about Joel, the list is endless. JoelAFreeman.com, his bio. WorkHardWorkSmart.com, one of his books. So there is so much to be said about Joel that, as I said to Joel earlier on, I want to do a whole show just about him. Folks, thank you so much for listening today. As I say, you don't have to be Jewish to appreciate Passover. You don't have to be Jewish to appreciate Israel. Lord knows many Christians are invited to a Passover service. Thank you, Joel. We love you. We bless you. We value you. We can't have you on often enough. You're always welcome on our show. So, folks, go out, celebrate Passover, celebrate Easter, celebrate miracles that will come your way if you believe in miracles. Celebrate resources, opportunities. Just keep your mind open. These are very significant holy days of Jews and Christians worldwide. Make every day significant. Here is our celebration song.
I was listening to Blog Talk Radio when my ears heard something that I did know. From the speakers of my laptop I heard a voice. It was the White Oprah, also known as Joyce.
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH.
Joyce Barry MASH.
She is a coaching smash.
He did the MASH. You'll catch on in a flash.
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH. I felt so inspired by her show, and her poetry was just so good, you know. I want to listen to Joyce again and again. As Joyce would say, if not now, when?
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH.
Joyce Barry MASH.
She is a coaching smash.
He did the MASH.
You'll catch on in a flash.
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH.
Wow.
Joyce knows all about having fun.
Wow.
She's a home business wizard and she's just begun.
Wow.
She's
wow.
a coaching sensation for not just me or
wow.
you or her. It's for everyone.
Then you can MASH.
Do the Joyce Barry MASH.
Joyce Barry MASH.
She's a home business smash.
Then you can MASH.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can MASH.
Do the Joyce Barry MASH.
Wow.
Have a fantastic day and listen to Joyce Barry and Friends.
And now, insurance-minded speeches from GEICO.
Hardship. My grandmother would go through it every month to pay her insurance bill. First, she would handwrite a paper check, in cursive. Then, using her own tongue, she would wet a stamp for an envelope. Today, however, we need not weary our hands and tongues. Today, we can pay our GEICO bill with the GEICO app. Away with hardship, in with bill pay on the GEICO app. Thank you.